I'm Taylor.
I'm Kat.
And welcome to Square Mile of Murder. Hi. It's been a minute.
1 or 2.
Yeah, just a handful, a casual handful of minutes. So yeah, now that we've kind of slayed our technological demons and families are no longer emergent. There's no more medical crises.
We can hope, at least.
Yeah, for now, for a couple days.
I'm quite impressed. We did manage to time both of us having family emergencies at the same time.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty efficient, if you ask me.
And it coincided with a technological...
It did.
Whatever that was.
Yeah, well, so maybe we should explain a little bit. Like, I kind of hinted at it in some of the stuff that we did release, but basically, we recorded the 100th episode, like, 2 weeks before it was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And I went to open up the files, and... Kat's audio was fine.
For
my
once.
Audio was super not fine. and basically it had like recorded at like double or triple speed. And there was this weird like noise over my tracks. So it was something that if we had released it, it would have made your ears bleed, probably. And thankfully, we did have, well, I always try to record a backup track of some kind, which is usually, like, the audio of our, like, Skype calls when we are recording. So, I did have that. It just took me a while to figure out how to properly use it and get it set up. So, yeah, it was a learning experience. I'd kind of gotten lax about like checking every time we recorded that everything was fine, and now I'm like back to that, like episode 10 frantic testing before recording thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and we're also soon going to start running out of spare episodes.
Yeah, so we're just going to have nothing.
So now, anything happens, it's tough shit.
Well, hopefully won't be any more major issues, but...
We live in hope.
Yes. But yeah, so we're back. And we're back with a new theme.
Yay!
And so this time, we're going to be doing some old Hollywood crimes. This was going to be February, but now it's going to be like February and March.
And boy, oh boy, did good old Tinseltown have its fair share of mysterious and suspicious deaths.
Oh, yeah. I mean, always, for sure. There's a lot to choose from. And I guess we should say, if we haven't picked, you know, the ones you want to hear the most, there will be time in the future for us to revisit a bunch of these. So
tell us, and then when award season comes around next year, because that was the reason originally for doing it in February, was like, oh, it's award season.
Yeah
let's talk about a bunch of shady people in Hollywood.
Right.
So yeah, by the time awards comes around next year, we can do some more.
Yeah, exactly. So unlike many of the older cases that we cover, there's like tons of information and sources on, you know, a lot of these high profile crimes and mysteries. So there's lots of sources. But, you know, in the kind of town where money and power can make any problem go away, it does mean there are also many, many conspiracies and conflicting stories and cover-ups, and it's hard to sometimes tell exactly what happened, and not all sources line up with each other. So one of these cases with many conflicting accounts and conspiracy theories is the mystery of who killed Superman, or at least the first actor to ever portray Superman on television, George Reeves. And the kickoff to what many call the Superman curse.
Oh, yeah.
We'd like to mention here that this episode discusses suicide, so please take care of yourself while listening and know that help is always available. And you can find a list of resources in the show notes for this episode.
George Reeves was born George Kiefer Brewster in Woolstock, Central Iowa, in January 1914. He was the son of Donald and Helen. His parents separated when George was young, and he and his mother moved around the Midwest for a number of years, with periods in Iowa, Kentucky, and Illinois, before heading to Pasadena, California, where when George was a teenager. He began his acting career as a teenager, studying and performing on stage at the Pasadena Junior College, before going on to perform at the Pasadena Playhouse, but he would soon move to the big screen. George Reeves began his film career in 1939 with Gone with the Wind, where he played the role of Stuart Tarleton, but he was one of Scarlett O'Hara's suitors, although he is wrongly credited as Brent Tarleton, who was actually played by Fred Crane. They played brothers. Between filming beginning in January and the film being released in December 1939, George Reeves returned to the Pasadena Playhouse, was snapped up by Warner Brothers, and appeared in four films, making Gone with the Wind his first film role, but fifth release. So he starred in many films throughout the next few years, signing contracts with various studios, including 20th Century Fox, Paramount, as well as the original Warner Brothers. He even acted alongside future president Ronald Reagan in Smashing the Money Ring and Newt Rockne All-American. But in 1942, something happened to change the course of his life and career.
So in 1942, George Reeves was cast in the war film So Proudly We Hail. He played the role of Lieutenant John Summers. And the film inspired him so much that he put his film career on hold and enlisted in the U.S. Army. The following year, the same year that the film came out, George was drafted into the now-defunct U.S. Army Air Forces. He also performed in the U.S. Army Air Forces Broadway show Winged Victory, and at one point was transferred to the First Motion Picture Unit to make training films. I have to say, how Hollywood relates to like the military and the Second World War is fascinating to me because it's all so like out there.
Yeah. Well, when I was kind of reading about this, I was thinking like making training films, I was like, well, of course the forces are going to have like some kind of production unit. Yeah. But you don't really think about it, do you?
No. So after being discharged from the army at the end of the war, George returned to Hollywood, but he struggled to restart his film career as Hollywood's golden age studio system began to slow down. He struggled to find many studio roles and ended up taking on a combination of low-budget films and other jobs to make ends meet. In 1949, he separated from his wife, Eleonora Needles, after 9 years of marriage. And their divorce was finalized the following year. After separating from his wife, he moved to New York City for 2 years, where he found work in the emerging television industry. And when he returned to Hollywood in 1951, George Reeves was offered the role of Superman in the series Adventures of Superman, which was the first live-action adaptation of Superman for television. Reeves was reportedly skeptical about taking a role on television, because it was still an emerging industry and not as established as cinema, and certainly not every home had a television like most do now. Now, although these days there's less stigma or sort of, we don't know how to phrase this, but basically,
yeah,
like,
yeah, I think the nearest we got was maybe stigma or social stigma.
Yeah, like, I think it was sometime, yeah, it's like, it's not a big deal now for serious film actors to go do TV, you know, which is thanks in part to, like, big budget shows like Game of Thrones, you know, multi-million dollar per episode kind of thing, and streaming services. Like, you can go do TV and then go do movies, and it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But for a long time, it was a big deal. And moving from cinema to television was pretty much a one-way street, and it was seen as, like, your career is over.
Yeah. Do you remember when we were doing our masters? I remember one of our first television lectures with Lisa. Mm-hmm. She was talking about how, I think it was actually Kevin Spacey when he started doing House of Cards.
Yeah.
Yeah. How, like, he was very vocal about how it's just content. It's not film and it's not television when it's on streaming. It's all content.
Yes.
And that part of that was because of, like, there is, or until the last few years, sort of like the early days of streaming, there was still that kind of, like, stigma, for lack of a better word, around moving from film into television and whether you can go between the two successfully.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think what's really interesting, like, even when we were younger, it was still very much a, you had movie stars and you had television actors, and never the twain shall meet. Like,
yeah,
you would never see Kate Winslet on TV, except now she's just done a TV show. And, like, it's so...
And you would never see a soap star go and do a big budget film, yet it happened.
Yeah. The whole system has changed so much. It's just really interesting. I mean, obviously, we have degrees in this shit, so I find this stuff really interesting.
Yeah. But regardless of his own and others' concerns about the television industry and how it would affect his career, George Reeves took the plunge, and in 1951 he starred in the B-movie Superman and the Mole Men.
Which I love.
Which was intended not just as a B-movie, which were low-budget films that ran during the second half of a double feature, but also as kind of a backdoor pilot and promotion for the upcoming TV series.
She's pretty smart.
Yeah. The television show was a success, and it made George Reeves a household name and face. But it did not make him rich. Unlike today, where being cast as the lead in, like, a DC or Marvel Comics adaptation would mean you're pretty much financially set for life. Back in the early days of television, you weren't paid much more than the average working class income. Not only that, but contracts for Reeves and his co-stars were incredibly restrictive because of this old studio system, which made it incredibly difficult for the actors to find other jobs in between filming Superman. Despite this, he did manage to find other work throughout the 50s, although he found himself typecast as a superhero, and these roles were usually small parts or in heavy costumes that obscured his face, so that nobody would recognize that Superman was in this, like, film that was totally different.
That's so wild.
Yeah. And he also made personal appearances, as, you know, we'll see many stars do. And according to a BuzzFeed Unsolved episode on George Reeves, because I couldn't find it anywhere else, he had been a boxer in his youth and partook in exhibition rounds as Superman.
Oh, I love that.
I would not want to be the guy who went up against.
No.
Like, it doesn't matter how well you do in real life, but in this exhibition bout, you're going down.
Yeah. You cannot beat Superman.
Yeah. And he also took his status as a role model quite seriously, appearing in educational films as Superman, and he even quit smoking, which was rare in the 50s.
Sure.
And by 1958, he had starred in over 100 episodes of Superman.
So while Reeves maintained a clean-cut image for the benefit of his young fans, his private life was much more complicated and definitely not suitable for general audiences.
I think that puts it mildly.
Yeah. In the early 1950s, just before the launch of the Supermission Teleman show.
Why don't you try that again?
Just before the launch of the Superman television show, George Reeves entered into a relationship with former showgirl and one-time actress Toni Mannix. While there's nothing immediately and obviously scandalous about a divorced actor dating a former showgirl, even back in the 50s, Toni Mannix was actually married to notorious studio executive Eddie Mannix, and had been married less than a year when George and Tony's relationship began. However, their relationship was an open secret in Hollywood, and Eddie Mannix reportedly not only knew about it, but also approved of his wife's affair with George Reeves. Because, wouldn't you know it, he was also having an affair, which was another one of Hollywood's open secrets. It's just like layers here, guys.
Like, I mean, at least like it's an open marriage and they're both happy.
Yeah, right? Oh my God, your video's back in sync. Oh, praise the Lord. So yeah, apparently the married couple would even holiday together with George Reeves and Mannix's mistress. And the four of them were all good friends, which is
so weird.
So fucked. But it's fine.
You know, different strokes for different folks.
I mean, like, I guess if it's... And a lot of these marriages in Hollywood were kind of arranged by the studios, too. So
yeah.
I kind of get it. But also... Like, thinking about it now, it's sort of like, that's weird, guys. But still. The relationship lasted until 1958, when Reeves began dating socialite Leonora Lemon from New York. And the couple planned to marry in the summer of 1959. By this time, the Superman TV show had ended, and George Reeves had begun to suffer financially. Because during his time on the show, many of his expenses, including his car, home, and clothes, had been paid for by Toni Mannix. But now that their relationship and the TV show had ended, and along with his struggle to find work because everyone just saw him as Superman, his money was running out quite quickly. He had previously written a pilot for his own television show called Port of Entry, but failed to secure funding. And similarly, in 1958, he had hoped to direct a science fiction film written by a friend from the Pasadena Playhouse, but once again, he failed to secure funding for the project and it was shelved.
In 1959, now aged 45, George Reeves was eager to move away from his role as Superman. And there are reports that he was being considered for a role in Alfred Hitchcock's upcoming film, Psycho. But that was not a sure thing. And it was not the lead. I can't remember. It was definitely like a supporting role.
Maybe it was the detective or something.
I think that's who it might have been. It wasn't like nominated.
Yeah, it wasn't Anthony Perkins' role.
Yeah. His other option was to reprise his role as Superman for a stage show and tour Australia. By this time, he had also allegedly become dependent on alcohol and drugs to cope with the depression brought on by his stalling career, struggled to step out of Superman's shadow, although some close to him have disputed this claim. Similarly, some close to him, including his mother, allegedly said that claims of financial issues and, you know, a career essentially in freefall were greatly exaggerated following his death, in June 1959.
So, in the early hours of June 16th, 1959, just days before they were supposed to be married, George and Leonora returned to George's home on Benedict Canyon Drive in West LA. And after they returned, Leonora turned on the porch light, which supposedly indicated that the home was open for visitors, despite it being like 1 in the morning.
I have many questions about this system.
Yeah.
That supposedly, you know, you turn on the porch light and, oh yeah, come over, even if we don't know you. And not only that, at 1 o'clock in the morning as well.
Would it just have been like a signal for people who knew that it was a signal, or was it like a thing that everyone knew and everyone did?
Well, it seemed to be at least that neighborhood, at least.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't someone you were particularly friendly with.
Just like, come on down, guys.
Mm.
Yeah. That's a weird one to me, but you know.
But also, if somebody comes to my house after 1 in the morning,
don't.
There better be, you know, either somebody is dead or I'm about to inherit a fortune, because those are the only two legitimate reasons to wake me up. That
or like my house is currently on fire and you'd like to let me know. That's pretty much the list right there. Yeah, it's a thing that happened apparently on Benedict Canyon back in the 50s. So who knows? So after, you know, flipping the switch, they were joined by neighbors William Bliss and Carol Van Ronkel, as well as their house guest Robert Condon, who had not joined them for dinner and remained at the house all evening. Carol Van Ronkel was rumored to possibly be having an affair with Robert Condon, who was staying with George and Leonora while he wrote a book about George. But William Bliss seems to have been relatively unknown to the rest of the group. He just swung by for drinks when the porch light was turned on, as you do. But George wasn't really in the mood for a party and threatened to throw their guests out, which I get because it was 1 a.m.
Yeah.
But it,
I'm with him on this one.
Yeah. But he soon apologized for his bad mood, but was also still irritated by the presence of other people in his home, and he left the room and headed upstairs. What happened next is the source of great controversy, and many conspiracy theories have cropped up around what actually happened that night, but we will start with the official version of events.
Yeah, so after George Reeves went upstairs, Leonora Lemon joked that he had gone upstairs to kill himself. Like, side note, not something to fucking joke about.
No.
And seconds later, a gunshot rang out. William Bliss, who remember was not a close friend, but rather just a neighbour, who neither George nor Leonora really knew, went upstairs and discovered George Reeves dead and naked in one of the bedrooms. Now, I do get that why he would be the one to go and look, because he is just an acquaintance.
Yeah, like there's lower stakes for him, I guess.
I could get why he would maybe be like, okay, I'll go see.
Yeah.
He had a gunshot wound to his right temple and was found laid back on the bed with his feet on the ground, as though he'd been sitting down and then fallen backwards after the shot was fired. A 9mm Luger was found at his feet, and a bullet casing was found beneath his body, but the bullet itself was lodged in the ceiling above his body. The bullet's gone through his right temple, up into the ceiling, and he's fallen backwards, not forwards.
Yeah.
Just something to think about. Now, two other bullets were later found in the wooden floor, but Leonora Lemon explained that away as she had tested the gun a few days earlier, and witnesses all reported hearing only the one gunshot.
I always test my gun in my bedroom.
Yeah. I totally don't go out into the backyard and shoot tin cans or anything.
Or, like, literally anything else. Like, yeah. Okay.
Officially, George Reeves was ruled to have taken his own life and died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. However, this is where the controversy arises.
Yeah. Many who knew George Reeves said that he wasn't depressed and wouldn't take his own life. But also, this was the 50s when mental health was not talked about as openly as it is today, which, as we all know, isn't all that open. So,
so
take it back even further. Just reel it in.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays it's like, oh yeah, we talk openly about it when it benefits somebody else.
Yeah. Regardless of George Reeves's state of mind, people have argued that there are other factors that point away from him having taken his own life. Some have claimed that his body had been washed and possibly even embalmed before an autopsy could be performed, meaning that no foreign fibers or hairs were found. Had George Reeves taken his own life, there would have been gunshot residue on his hands. But because his body had been cleaned, the residue was, in theory, washed away. But on the other hand, if he had been murdered, there would be no gunshot residue on his hands, and an autopsy would have figured that out. So some believed that he was murdered, and that his body was washed to solve the issue of there being no gunshot residue. But
yeah,
if he was murdered, who would have had the motive to kill him?
Some believe that someone had lain in wait for George Reeves and murdered him when he entered the room. However, an article from The Guardian in 2006 actually noted that the bedroom was windowless.
To which I say, A, code violation. B, that just sounds terrible.
Although, part of me is kind of like, you would get a good night's sleep.
You would. It'd be dark. That's true.
But then you'd have no idea what the weather was like. You'd have no natural waking up light.
Yeah.
There's just so many issues.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine if you're on like a mini cruise to Amsterdam.
Yeah. But like, I have questions for this architect, you know?
Yeah. Not for your whole life. Not your main bedroom.
No, definitely not.
But a lot has been made about this, and some point out that an assassin would have had to pass William Bliss on the stairs as they left the house. But also, like, there were other bedrooms, so we could have, like, killed him, gone into another room, and then fled out of a window.
Yeah.
But William Bliss was not known. Spooky conspiracy vibes. Others have pointed towards Leonora Lemon and her alleged extreme mood swings and tempers, and a version of events claims that she went upstairs with George before the shot rang out and then ordered the guests to tell the police that he was alone and that William Bliss was the one who found the body. But these claims are all unsubstantiated. Were actually made by Fred Crane, who was his co-star in Gone with the Wind.
Hmm.
Who wasn't there that night. these claims are all unsubstantiated. And if it wasn't Leonora Lemon who killed George Reeves and he didn't take his own life, who was responsible? Well, other than the vague suggestion that someone was waiting for George in the room or that Leonora Lemon was the killer, the only real suspects are Eddie and Tony Mannix.
Yeah. So, remember how we said that Eddie Mannix was a notorious film producer? Well, producer might have been his official title, but he was also known to most in Hollywood as a fixer for MGM Studio and its founder, Louis B. Mayer.
Interestingly, George Reeves was never under contract for MGM.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like,
you had five majors and three five big, three little.
Yeah.
He was on for half of them.
Yeah.
But never MGM. Even though he was dating the wife of the fixer.
And apparently everyone was cool with that. So go figure. Now, Mannix reportedly grew up with the likes of Bugsy Siegel and had many criminal contacts, including the mob, East and West Coast mob, all the mobs, all of them.
Yeah. I mean, the East Coast was bad enough, but you got the West Coast as well. I mean, probably down in New Orleans.
Get them all in there.
Maybe even Chicago.
Oh, sure.
Now, Bugsy Siegel, if you don't know, was a big player in the New York organized crime business.
Yeah.
And was closely affiliated with the five families of the New York Mafia. Although he himself could not be a made man because he was Jewish and he was not Sicilian.
Yeah.
But he was him and Maya Lansky. They were both Jewish, so they couldn't technically be part of the mob, but they were...
They were part of the mob.
they were in the mob. Bugsy Siegel was also one of the driving forces behind the Flamingo Hotel, which was... one of, if not the first hotel in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Because gambling and prostitution was legal in Nevada.
Oh, sure is.
And someone had to take advantage of it.
Gotta do it. It's, that is the prime place for, for a mob type organization.
And he himself suffered a very mysterious death.
Yes.
Well, it's not mysterious. He was shot in the head.
I mean, yeah.
The question arises around who did it.
Yeah, there's that.
I mean, it's an occupational hazard of being in the mob.
Yeah, it's not an uncommon way to die when you're running with those types. So yeah, in his role as a fixer, Mannix reportedly had covered up all kinds of scandals, including extramarital affairs, abortions, even sexual assault allegations against some of the studio stars, and supposedly he had the connections to make people and problems disappear or, you know, drop dead. Or possibly both.
Yeah. Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
Disappeared, and I think it's fair to say probably died the same day.
Probably. I'd say so. Now, although Mannix had been supportive of Tony's relationship with George Reeves, he was said to be angry when the relationship ended. This is all so backwards.
Yeah. You just gotta roll with it.
Now, Tony was heartbroken by the separation and Reeves' new relationship with Leonora Lemon. So Eddie took revenge on George for breaking his wife's heart. In the months leading up to his death, George Reeves had also suffered a number of accidents, including a suspicious car accident where his brake fluid had been drained.
Side note, Eddie Mannix's first wife, Bernice, had died in a car accident in 1937. And some believed that Mannix was actually responsible for her death because he was a good Catholic who didn't believe in divorce and Bernice wanted out of the marriage.
Such a good Catholic.
Yeah. Again, all allegations. Nobody knows for sure, and Bernice's death was officially ruled an accident.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So the biggest supporter of the idea that George Reeves had been murdered was Tony Mannix, who rang up Phyllis Coates just hours after his death, claiming that he had been murdered. Phyllis Coates played Lois Lane opposite George Reeves in The Adventures of Superman, and they had remained friends after the show ended. I'm going to read that sentence again. They had remained...
You finished early.
Yeah. They had remained friends after the show ended. Although the other suspect in conspiracies... Oh my god.
conspiracy theories.
Although the other suspect in conspiracy theories about George Reeves' death is Tony herself. with some suggesting that she'd used her husband's criminal contacts to have George killed as revenge for leaving her. She had previously stolen his pet dog just to hurt him. It hurt George, not the dog.
Yeah, not the dog. Thankfully. The dog was fine, as far as we know.
Yeah. Let's hope.
Tony Mannix allegedly confessed on her deathbed that she and Eddie had arranged George Reeves' murder, but as it was on her deathbed, no further information is known about how they did this or who actually pulled the trigger, or if it's even true or just somebody made it up. The Mannixes, mainly Eddie Mannix, also served as the inspiration for the 2014 Coen Brothers film Hail Caesar. And that is the story of George Reeves and the mysterious death of Superman.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
I was going to say, what do you think happened?
I don't know. I do have some thoughts, though. Because, like, there's always conspiracy theories arise when there's a high-profile death, especially when someone takes their own life.
Yeah.
I know it's a different sort of context, but when Jeffrey Epstein died, mm-hmm. everyone was like, oh my god, he couldn't have killed himself, someone else did it, so he couldn't tell the truth. And I'm like, a rich guy who's got away with everything his whole life is about to be convicted, or at least go to trial, as the one of the biggest pedophiles in America's history, highest profile, so many links to so many other people. You think he's going to have an easy ride in prison? No. Hell no. Of course it makes sense that he took his own life.
Yeah.
Whether he did or not, obviously, will be debated for years to come.
Yeah.
But everyone was nobody was willing to accept that he would take his own life. It's like, really? You don't think he could take his own life? Given what was about to happen to him?
Yeah.
So, any high-profile death, there's so many conspiracy theories. Princess Diana.
Yeah.
Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
Similar time period. You know, all... So, I don't know what happens. I think it's... I don't know a lot about bullet trajectory, but I find it strange that the bullet is in the ceiling, but the shot went through his head and he felt like...
Yeah.
That confuses me. Like, because I would have thought for the bullet to go upwards, he would have ended up falling forwards, or at least to the side and not flat on his back.
Yeah.
But again, people look for conspiracy theories where none exist.
Yeah, for sure.
And they look for cover-ups where none exist, I should say. So, I don't really know.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think the weirdest part is the three bullets. Like...
Yeah.
That's just strange. And it just seems awfully convenient that the story of, well, I was testing our gun just a few days before, and some bullets lodged themselves in our bedroom floor. Like, that's weird. But also, you know, weird stuff happens.
But also, like, so there's the first gunshot. If you're, like, they've all been drinking.
Yeah.
There's a gunshot. There's a panic.
Yeah.
Is it possible to have, like, been in such a panic
that you wouldn't that have heard?
You don't notice there's another two shots?
It's possible.
Or that maybe you're not sure, and then when you're talking about, like, someone's running through events later, they're like, oh, and there was a gunshot and blah, blah, blah. And so you think, oh, well, maybe I just imagined it.
Yeah. Or even, like, if they were in close enough succession, could have sounded like one. You know, if it was like two shots quickly went into the floor.
Hmm.
But I guess if someone was there in the room with him, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Like, I want to be like, nah, this was, it just, like, stuff doesn't line up. And to me, that doesn't necessarily mean that someone murdered him, but it just seems like the facts are, like, in the wrong order, or something's been left out, or something. But, yeah, it's all a bit hinky, but I don't quite know why, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, like you said, it seems like there's something missing information-wise, but don't know what.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
So, yeah. One thing I did find interesting during the research is almost all the sources, like, line up. Unlike a lot of, like, really old and high-profile cases where there's so many conflicting versions of events. Everything lines up except for, like, these conspiracy theories about who pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's all my thoughts. I don't have many thoughts on this.
No, it's, yeah. It's just one of those that's like, it like eats at the back of your mind because you just turn it over and over and over in your head. But I feel like I always come to the same conclusion of like, it could go either way.
Yeah. Actually, another thing I just thought of, like, so he was seen as, like, this great role model for kids. And, like, at a time when mental health was not talked about and, you know, depression or taking your own life was seen as, like, serious weakness and not, like, a thing that happens and you need help for, it's also possible that people would prefer to come up with this theory that someone murdered him rather than believe that this person they've built up as like on a pedestal as this great role model for children
is just a person
would actually take their own life.
No, I could see that too. I mentioned it at the top of the show, but this is the beginning of the Superman curse, quote unquote.
Oh yeah.
Which is kind of, you know, it held a lot of water up until about 2010 or something, I'd say. But since then, there have been a lot more people involved in Superman productions that have not mysteriously died or gotten in terrible accidents. But I guess we should do a quick rundown. But basically, the big ones are George Reeves.
Yeah.
Mysterious death. Christopher Reeve, no relation, who played Superman in the films in like the 70s and 80s.
So I've got the Wikipedia page for the Superman curse. Yeah. So Christopher Reeve portrayed him in 4 theatrical films from 1978 to 1987.
Yeah.
And he was paralyzed in a horseback riding accident in 1995 and died 9 years later from heart failure at the age of 52.
Yes. Yeah. So Kirk Allen was another actor who played Superman in some low budget films in the 40s, but couldn't find work because everyone saw him as Superman.
Mm-hmm. So is he a voice actor then?
It says low budget serials. Oh, maybe it was,
Kirk Allen was an American actor best known for being the first actor to play DC Comics character Superman in live action.
Oh.
For the 1948 movie serial.
Okay.
So it was film serial rather than a TV series. Okay. I was getting confused because I was thinking, I thought George Reeves was the first one.
Yeah.
But he was the first on television.
Yeah.
Lee Quigley played Superman as a baby in the 1978 film. He died in 91 at the age of 14 from solvent abuse.
Yeah.
That's not nice.
No.
Huh? Then we have George Reeves, Christopher Reeve. Other alleged victims, Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
So
he played Jor-El in the 1978 film, which is Superman's father?
I am not very well versed on the Superman universe, so
Jor-El is Superman's biological father from Krypton.
So he's cited for the misfortune he suffered in his private life. such as his son shooting his half-sister's boyfriend in 1990 and a 5-year imprisonment. His own admission in court that he failed his son and daughter. His daughter took her own life in 1995, and he then became a recluse.
Yeah. And yeah, there's like a handful of other things here. The one I found really interesting was Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster created Superman, the comics. And they sold it to DC Comics for like a very small amount of money compared to what it would go on to make. And basically, Siegel basically lived in destitution for most of his life until DC threw them both a bone and gave them a like a monthly pension or yearly pension or something. And then another one that we know all about.
It's
good old Allison Mack, who played a character in Smallville, the Superman TV show from the WB in like the early 2000s. Listen to episode 71.
Oh, yeah, good. I had no idea what number it was. Basically, the cult episodes.
Yes.
Just go through them.
Nexium is the main one she features in. But yeah, it's not great. But
no.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting. Which, like, it's kind of, to me, the Superman curse is kind of like the Kennedy curse. Where, like, it does seem like everything bad happens to this one family, or everything bad happens to people involved in this TV franchise or whatever. But there's tons of Superman adaptations, so there's tons of people who work on them. So there's a higher likelihood that someone's going to befall, you know, a terrible fate. Just like there are tons of Kennedys. So
also, the,
like, statistically,
the Kennedys were in bed with the mob.
I mean, yeah.
That significantly reduces your life expectancy.
The Kennedys were in bed with everyone.
I'm not here to slut shame the Kennedys.
In literally every way possible. But, like, I mean, the fact of their associations and the fact that there are just buckets of Kennedys. The world is lousy with them. They are everywhere. And so you have that many people and they're in the public eye. You're going to notice more bad things happening to this one subset of people, as is the same with the Superman thing. So, like, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's like loads of horror films as well.
Yeah.
Like, oh, horror films are cursed because a bunch of people died. Well, people die.
Yeah.
It's a really sad fact of life. And so Brendan Lee was shot with a railgun instead of a prop gun on the set of The Crow. And someone else who worked on The Crow also died. And someone who worked on The Exorcist died mysteriously. Mm-hmm. You know, but
that happens.
The 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were so many horror films being made.
Yeah.
Some of them truly shocking, you know. But there's, like, an abundance of, like, Superman adaptations and other comic book adaptations. There's so many of them.
Yeah.
If you want to, like, look at it, want to put your tin hat on and look at it like that, of course you're going to see connections everywhere, because that happens.
Yeah, like, if you're looking for the connections, you'll find them.
Yeah, it's like confirmation bias. Yeah. If you're looking for it, of course you're going to find it.
But also, conspiracies. So,
I mean, I love a good conspiracy, but I don't believe in, like, the Superman curse or whatever.
Like,
kind
of
like,
it's, you know, a series of unfortunate coincidences. but I don't think there's anything else to it.
Nah.
So, yeah.
Let us know what you think happened.
Please do. And if you know, if you happen to attend Tony Mannix's deathbed confession, let us know what she said. I want to know.
Yeah.
And once you've done that, once you've relayed that information to us, if you like the show, you should go rate and review us on your podcast app, especially if you're on Apple Podcasts. And you should subscribe so you never miss a new episode, whether it be Florida Man or Old Hollywood.
Yeah.
We
cover everything.
We got it all, really, guys. Mm. Or 16th century witches? 15th century witches? Forget.
12th century witches.
Old witches. Basically. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you should do that. And if you want to get some Square Mile merch, we have some new merch designs on some products. And you can buy them and wear them on your person or hold them in your hand. So if you want to take a look at those, there's a link in our show notes and on our website, or you can go to squaremileofmurder.store. So check them out.
And if you'd like to help us cover the costs of making the podcast and help us invest in the future of the show, create our production company, go on our trip to the Espionage Museum in Berlin, go to Bletchley Park, what have I missed? We have lots of plans we need money for. you can join our Patreon page. Tiers start at just £1 per month. Every patron gets regular episodes a day early, a shout out on the show, priority case requests, and a lifetime discount on merch. And that's just for £1 a month. As the tiers go up, you get even more, including bonus episodes and exclusive merch that you can't buy anywhere. So check all that out at patreon.com/squaremileofmurder. Links are in all the usual places.
And will be back with more old Hollywood shenanigans.
So we'll see you then. Yeah,
thanks for listening. Bye.